of each and every one of you here tonight. Appreciate the opportunity that's been extended, been afforded me to come and be with you and study for a little while together this evening. I told Cloyce a little bit ago, he asked me how I was doing. I said, I've been battling a slipped disc in my back for about the last 3 weeks. So if you should see me fall down or start twitching or something like that, just ignore me. If I fall down, maybe Cloyce can jump up here and the lesson. Getting better, so that's always a good thing. If your Bible's with you, you might open to 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. We're going to begin our study together from verse number 20. This particular story is one of my favorites in all the Bible. It's not so much of what goes on or even necessarily what Elijah has to say as much as it is the fact that I identify with Elijah's sarcastic humor. As I read this, every time I read it, every time I study it, I can't help but start laughing when I get to certain parts of it. Partly because that's just the way I am, but also I see the same ridiculousness in the situation that he does, but we'll get to that here in just a few moments. But this is a rather interesting story that we find in 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. As we know through Israelite history, the people of Israel go in cycles. You know, one day they are pleasing to God, and they're serving God, and they're happy with God, and everything's just great and hunky-dory. And then another day passes, and then they start looking at other peoples or other gods or what's going on there, and they start drifting, and then they become enslaved to what's going on there. And they get so caught up in it, they no longer really care about God. And so the people come up and oppress them, and then they realize their situation. They cry out to God, oh, how unfair this is. Come, please save us, blah, blah, blah. God sends somebody to deliver his people, and everything's happy again, only for the cycle to start seemingly the very next day. Here you had, again, the very same situation. In this particular chapter, we're discussing a particular king, King Ahab. Good king, bad king. He's a bad king, for all intents and purposes here. And Elijah has come to the place of Mount Carmel, where he is going to do battle of sorts here in just a few moments. But before we really get into the discussion of the text, I want us to read the text together so we all know we're on the same page and so forth. Beginning there in verse 20 of 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. And then Elijah said to the people, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now let them give us two oxen, and let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood, and I will put a fire under it. And you will call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people said, it's a good idea. And so Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one ox for yourselves and prepare it first for your many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. And then they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they made. And it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside or is on a journey or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened. So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom, the swords and lances till the blood gushed out on them. And when midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering and the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And so all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord which had been torn down. And Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again. When the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench, when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape." And so they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slew them there. I wanted to very quickly just look at the geography of our story here. Probably very familiar with Mount Carmel. We know just from studies and classes and whatnot that Carmel is the little piece that sticks out here into the Mediterranean Sea. Mount Carmel would actually be back over this direction a little bit, not quite on the coast. Although I guess in your mind, you think about the Mount Carmel, you think about the one piece that sticks out there. And if you had a picture in your mind, like I have had in mind over the years, of this beautiful look, vista out into the ocean, and all that while this stuff is taking place. There are people who are far smarter than I who think it's back inland a little bit. But whether it is or not, it doesn't really matter. This next couple of pictures are a couple of pictures I found of a statue that our brother David Padfield from up in Illinois took when he was over there visiting. It's a statue of Elijah that commemorates the story that we are reading here in 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. But what I want us to see right off the bat here with this particular story is the fact that this challenge that Elijah makes is equal in everything, in every way in which it is presented to the people. Elijah is not pulling any strings here. He's not asking for it to be done in private. He's not asking the prophets of Baal to take a handful of their guys, you know, select a few, and let's go back here in the woods or someplace like that and do it. He wants to do this way out in the open. He wants the people of Baal to be able to see for themselves, and also the people of Israel, to see for themselves these great things. Now, it's interesting to me that it shows the confidence, I guess perhaps would be a better way to put it, the confidence that Elijah has right off the bat. He knows what's going to happen. He understands what is at stake here, and he understands there is no other God but God. There's no such thing as a Baal. But for the benefit of the people who have a hard time remaining faithful to Yahweh, to Jehovah God, he is going to put this down there in front of everybody. This is a challenge of monumental proportions. This is not some small thing that is going to take place, and he wants everybody to be able to see it. If we go back there in verses 18 and 19 of this chapter, we find here that the people of God, as we've already stated, are worshiping other gods. They're worshiping Baal. They no longer are following God as they should. And so he presents them with a very simple question. How long are you going to wait? A very simple question is put forth, not just to the prophets of Baal, but most importantly, to God's people. How long are you going to wait? We're going to talk more about this if we have time later in the lesson. But I want us to think about this right off the bat. How long will people today wait to make a decision to follow God or not? In particular, I'm thinking of people who find it convenient to identify with the Savior, who find it convenient to call themselves a Christian or want to have that kind of association. But their manner of life says something entirely different. It's almost as if we'd rather be identified as a Christian when it's convenient for us. That's something we have to be very, very careful of, that we not turn it into a convenience issue. So Elijah says, how long are you going to wait? You need to make up your mind. You have to decide today just what exactly it is you're going to do, who exactly it is that you are going to serve. In other words, make up your mind and follow somebody. It's kind of reminiscent of what Jesus said in Revelation 3, wasn't it? The folks at Laodicea, you're neither hot nor cold. I wish you'd make up your mind and do something. I don't know which way, how I'm supposed to handle you. I don't know how I'm supposed to deal with you right now because you're hot and you're cold. You're just kind of lukewarm. Make up your mind. Make a decision as to what you're going to do. Look at the challenge that is offered here by Elijah. Each side, we're told, would receive an ox. He says there in verse number 23, now let them give us two oxen. Each one would receive an ox. Each one was instructed to cut it up and place it on the altar. Each one was to place no fire underneath it. Each one was to cry to their own God in order to see which one would answer. And Elijah just simply says, look, if you cry out to you cry out to Baal and Baal answers you, he responds to you and your sacrifice that you're making, he's God. So, but on the other hand, if my God, if I cry out to him and he responds to me, then he's the God. And so he's laying all of this out there on the table for everybody to see, for everybody to understand and to recognize that somebody is going to win. And whichever side gets a response, and that would be the one that they would acknowledge as being the true God. Verses 24 through 29, we see this challenge by the prophets of Baal. And even the people of God, they said, hey, this is a great idea there in verse 24. Great idea. That sounds great, Elijah. Let's do that. And so they do. We're told here that the people of Baal began to prepare their oxen, and they began to call on their god Baal. We're told that they do this from early morning all the way up to the time of the evening sacrifice. So this is an all-day affair that's taking place here. And this is the part that I always start to laugh just a little bit. This is the part that makes me giggle a little bit. I can't help it. You know, if you're down there in Clarksville and you're walking through the building and you hear somebody laughing, it's probably me, and I might be reading this exact lesson. Because you get to the point where as they're jumping about and they're calling on Baal there in verse number 26, oh, Baal, answer us. You know, they're just carrying on, crying out to Baal, and nothing is happening. Can you imagine being Elijah right here? Can you imagine being Elijah at this particular moment, early in the morning? You already know the story. You know how it's going to end. But you're going to placate these people, and you're going to give them an opportunity. You're going to give them a chance. And so he's sitting back, and he's watching as the prophets of Baal are doing their thing. And he begins to kind of poke them a little bit. He pokes them a little bit there in verse number 27. We're told that right about noontime, he says, call out with a loud voice, for he is a God. Now, maybe he just can't quite hear you now because gods are just so strong and powerful, and they got so many people vying for their attention that perhaps maybe he just yell a little bit louder. Maybe you can overshout everybody else and he'll be able to hear you. He says, perhaps maybe he's just occupied. You know, maybe Elijah's saying, you have to take that. They pull that ticket, you know, now serving number 8,432, and right now Baal is on number 4. You know, your wait time is long, is real long here. Elijah continues on. He says, maybe he's just gone on a journey. Maybe he forgot to set his alarm clock, he says, or maybe he's just sleeping and needs to be awakened. Just cry a little bit louder. What does that do to the people, to the prophets? We're told they take things a little bit further, don't they? Now, not only are they now screaming and hollering and carrying it on, now they start to cut themselves. I never quite understood that. You know, if you try to get somebody's attention, how harming yourself will cause them to take notice of you that much quicker. But that's what they do here. We're told here that the blood just gushed. These people are carrying on. They're going on and on. Oh, Baal, hear us, cut myself, jump up and down, yelling and screaming, and nothing happens. Finally get to the time, the text tells us, about the evening sacrifice. And Elijah begins to put on what I would call his serious face. He sat back and he's watched the show. He's like me, maybe he's got a diet due in one hand and a bag of popcorn in the other, watching the show. Again, knowing full well how this is all going to end, what the end result is going to be. He's let them carry on. But at this particular moment in time, late in the day, he finally says, you know what, enough's enough. You've cried out to your God, you have done all these things, and nothing has worked yet. You haven't been able to get his attention for whatever reason. He's not responding to you. He says, now basically sit down and be quiet and listen. Does he not call the people together? He finally says, enough's enough, and he says, people of Israel, gather around. And Elijah begins to put on his side of things. And we're told there in verse number 30, after he calls the people together, he repairs the altar of the Lord that had been torn down. He takes 12 stones, indicating the 12 tribes of Israel. And he takes the ox that has been cut up. He puts it on the altar. What happens? Nothing yet, because he builds a trench, doesn't he? He builds a trench around the altar, puts up the sacrifice on that altar, and then immediately lights it, right? No, he tells the people to do what? Get the pitcher of water and pour over it. They said, okay, we've done that. He says, do it again. And they do it. He says, do it a third time. And they do it. The text tells us here that the water flowed around the altar. You can just get a mental picture in your mind of what is going on here. These people earlier in the day jumping around, hollering and screaming, cutting themselves and all this kind of stuff.
And here Elijah seemingly is doing everything he can to make sure that he's not successful. I mean, who, if you're going to offer a sacrifice, if you're going to burn something, if you're going to burn wood, if you're going to burn paper, who in their right mind pours water on stuff? But Elijah has watched the show today. And he says, I'm going to prove to you people who God is and who the real, true, almighty God is. And there in verse 36, wow, here's a great contrast, a great comparison. While the prophets of Baal were leaping and jumping and screaming and hollering and crying out all that, what does Elijah do? He just offers a very simple prayer, doesn't he? He doesn't really make a big production about it, doesn't make a real big show about it. He just simply prays. He says, oh Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Interesting that he mentions that. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Why would he do that? One of the things that we know throughout Scripture, Old Testament, New Testament, is that from the point when God brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, did God ever go back and remind his people who had done that for him? Occasion after occasion after occasion, God would remind his people, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And you had the Passover, which would commemorate that event, but also just as a reminder of what I had done. These people, not these people, but the people of Israel, their predecessors, they were there in Egypt as the plagues descended upon the land. They got to see all the things that were done to Pharaoh and against his people. They got to walk, Cloyce mentioned, in the parting of the Red Sea. Can you imagine how cool that must have been? I mean, I don't know if we ever really think about that, how cool that must have been, to be able to walk across a seabed, dry ground. But can you imagine walking past and seeing all the fish there staring at you as you're walking past? Be able to go out and cross the land, go to places where the water is bitter, or maybe there's no water at all, there's no food. And by speaking to a rock, hitting a rock, praying to God, whatever the circumstances called for, God provided. You imagine going into the land of Canaan and all the things that were there, and you know, initially the 12 spies. I mean, we just see time and time and time again how God has provided, he has cared for his people. These other folks, the prophets of Baal, have been crying out to them. Baal still hasn't answered them. But all along, God has shown that he cares for his people. He provides for them, making sure that their physical necessities are taken care of. Elijah says, oh Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, that I am your servant, that I have done all these things at your word. Those are pretty impressive words, aren't they? That's a pretty neat statement that Elijah would call to mind, that God would be remembered that day that he is God. But it also, at least as I look at it, a stinging indictment against his people because they had forgotten. They had forgotten who God was. They needed to be reminded of who exactly he was. He says, answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their heart back again. Verse 38 tells us that at that moment the fire of the Lord fell, consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the water. Notice the detail here, down even not to just the stones, but to what? The dust that was there. This was an all-consuming fire. There would be no doubt. There was no spontaneous combustion taking place here. There was nothing that would be left in the minds of these people, whether the people of Israel or the prophets of Baal, that would show that this fire somehow started by some other means. Because remember, Elijah has done everything he could to make sure that this fire doesn't start by pouring the water on it. Not one time, not two times, but three times. And yet this fire from heaven comes down and consumes everything. So much so that it has this desired result. So much so that the people realize that Elijah is right, that he is true, and that there is the Almighty God. The God that he serves is the God that they should be serving as well. After this happens, verse 40 tells us that Elijah tells them to seize the prophets of Baal, takes them down to the brook Kishon, which, depending on where you place Mount Carmel, right at the base of the mountain there, and they slew the prophets of Baal. Now, one of the things we didn't talk about, but that we showed Elijah prior to this, just as the story was getting started, felt that he was the only one of God's people left. The only person who cared about God, the only person who cared about them, and so on and so forth. He is the one with this great message to come and to save God's people. The remaining time that we have together tonight, I'd like for us to consider some application. Like I said, this is a very tremendous story, one of my favorites in all the Scriptures. Because of not just the sarcasm that Elijah used, but there's just so many lessons that should be learned, should be taken. one of the first things that jumped out to me on the page is the fact that just as Elijah told the people of Israel, you need to make up your mind, the same is true for us today. We mentioned this a little bit ago, but I want to go a little bit further with it. You know, we today need to make up our mind as to who exactly it is that we're going to serve. I'm afraid there are too many of us that view being a Christian, being a child of God, is something more of a convenient thing. When it's convenient, I'm going to be a Christian. When it's easy, I'm going to be a Christian. But those moments where maybe there's something else I'd rather be doing, some other thing that maybe I want to look out in the world and man, they're having a great time on Friday night or Saturday night or whatever it is. I look at all the great things that they're doing and all the enjoyment it brings them and how much excitement there is. And we all want to be excited. We want to be enjoying ourselves and all that. We see that out there and we say, I want that. And so Monday through Saturday, we're out doing what the world wants us to do. But on Sundays, we're back praising God and thanking Him and hoping that what we've done throughout the week doesn't come to fruition. Maybe you've heard the little saying, as I have, you spend Monday through Saturday sowing wild oats, and come Sunday, you go in and pray for a crop failure. And I wonder how many times do we do that? How many of us are on the verge of serving God, but for whatever reason, we can't take that final step and begin to serve Him? You know, Joshua had a very important statement. And a statement we all know is a very popular passage, a very well-known passage, where Joshua says, you choose this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. It's not easy being a Christian. I had a guy tell me a couple years ago that he felt it was. And I said, well, brother, you need to sit down with me and teach me. Because I see what's going on out in the world. There are temptations that I have to deal with. There are things that make it difficult for me to be a Christian. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, we give in and so on, but you know what, I suppose it could be, too, that if we find it easy to be a Christian, you know, one, either we are oblivious to what's going on around us, or maybe we just have it down pat and we've got it down good. And like I said, if that's the case, you need to write a book. You can make millions. Because in my experience, being a Christian isn't easy. There are temptations that I face each and every day. Some small, some major, some in between. I'm sure that's probably true on the rest of you. You have a problem with pride, thinking more highly of yourself than you ought to think. You have a problem maybe with uncontrolled anger. Somebody says one word to you, you fly off the handle at them. Maybe you have a problem with lust. Maybe it's a lust of another person, or maybe it's a lust of an object of some kind. You have a problem with lying. We live in a time where it's okay to tell little white lies. I'm going. I can use the example of my wife coming in and asking me, you know, honey, does this look okay on me? You know, experience has taught me to be very careful. My wife and I just celebrated 17 years last Friday. 17 years. Some things I forget is probably good. But there are some things you have to be very careful in answering. And so I have found the best way to handle that, guys, is, you know what, honey, it doesn't flatter you. You know, it's not quite no, you know, come up with some big thing, but also at the same time, you don't let her go out of the house knowing full well she doesn't look good in it. And that's what she wants to know, if it's okay to do that. You know, it's the small things, and we kind of laugh about that kind of stuff, and we say, oh, it's no harm, no foul, but really isn't. Isn't harm committed when we're willing to lie about small things? Because what happens is the small things turn into large things. We think it's okay to lie in one situation, why not lie here? And it just keeps going and going and going. So as we look at it, as you look at your life, as you look at the problems that you may encounter, we understand that being a Christian is not easy. One of the best things that you can do is to resolve in your heart today who it is that you're going to serve. If you don't care about God, if you're tired of serving Him, if you're tired of being blessed by Him, if you're tired of whatever it is of being known as a child of God, the best thing to do is turn your back on it and go. Free yourself of that. But if on the other hand, though, you want to be a Christian, you want to continue to be blessed by God, and you want the ultimate reward that we strive for, we need to resolve to do that today and hang on. You have to do that. You have to be willing to hold on to Him. Over in Luke chapter 9, verse 57 through 16, you can read those later if you like. But Jesus lays that out. It's not easy to be a Christian. You need to make sure that you are prepared to go the extra mile with Him. You need to understand that with it will come hard times, will come difficult times, but you must be willing. If you want to do it, if you want to serve Him, then you must be willing to follow through with it. A second thing to note here, just as Elijah showed for us there in verses 36 and 37 of our text, we too need to have an unshakable faith in the Almighty. Put yourself in the sandals of Elijah at this particular moment. Now, granted, he's got this little complex about himself that, poor, pitiful me, I'm the only one that is still alive and serving God today. Now, God would remind you that's not the case, and there are other people he's just not aware of. But right now, Elijah is the only one on the face of the planet that is concerned about serving God. Prophets of Baal, they number 450. Do you think maybe Elijah felt a little bit of pressure? Maybe not to stand up and be so vocal. Doesn't seem to be that way, does it? Because he does what? He calls everybody together. He says, folks, gather around. Gather around. We're going to do something. We have a little bit of an experiment here. And we're going to do this thing, and it will be out here in front of everybody. It's one against an entire nation of people and at least 450 prophets. Elijah has an unshakable faith in the Almighty. He understands and knows beyond a shadow of a doubt who God is and what God is capable of doing. To sit there, you have to be able to sit there all day long while all the shenanigans are taking place. And all this yelling and shouting and jumping up and down and cutting and all this kind of stuff that's happening, to sit there and watch all of that and then stand up and say, now watch this. Over in Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse number 1, it's a passage we're all very, very familiar with. Anytime we talk about faith, anytime we try to identify faith, we turn to this passage and we read it. He says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things that are not seen. You know, sometimes we as Christians, we are faced with insurmountable odds. You know, there are times where our faith is challenged, where we really sit up and take notice as to whether or not we are as strong a child of God as we claim to be. It's one thing about being a Christian. It's easy to be a Christian when the sky is blue and the birds are chirping and the flowers are blooming. It's easy when you have no problems, when you have no issues. It's something entirely different when things go wrong. But that same thing, like anything, is going right. I can remember 7 years ago, my wife and I found out that we were going to enjoy the arrival of our third child. And I remember that shortly after we found out that she was pregnant, she'd gone to the doctor for just the blood test and all that. The doctor calls and says, you're going to have problems. You're going to have issues. And I can remember hearing that come out of her mouth as I'm down at the office on the phone, and she's calling, and she's all upset. And as the pregnancy progressed, what it was a called anti-little C. It's kind of like the RH factor, but it's more of a cousin of the RH factor. It's not quite the same thing, but very similar. And as the pregnancy progressed, the doctors told us that for the first 5 months, there's not a thing in the world we can do. And what happened was that there was an antigen in my wife's body that was viewing our son as an infection. And antigen doing its part, doing its role, you know, fighting off infection, began to break down the red blood cells of our son. And so for the first 5 months, the doctor says, nothing we can do. During the course of a 9-month pregnancy, my wife underwent 5 amniocentesis. We were having to go to Norton's, started out once a month and then twice a month. And as we progressed with the pregnancy, we were going every week, having ultrasounds done and just the whole 9 yards. At one point in time, we were told that if her numbers kept climbing, which was bad, that they would have to do a blood transfusion in utero. Thankfully, we went through prayer and all that, the numbers declined and went through, and he was born a healthy baby boy who just turned 7 at the end of January this year. During all of that, as if that wasn't enough, our insurance says, Mr. Campbell, I'm sorry, but you know we're not going to cover this. Great. So through all of that, we had accumulated almost $40,000 worth of medical debt that we had no way of really being able to pay. You want to talk about being, you know, looking into the book, and at the time being 28 years of age, and having two kids, two small children who you're trying to raise up, and all these things that are going on, you're looking at, you hear all the horror stories, you're looking at the medical debt, you're looking mostly at the health of your child. And you're thinking, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Sorry, I was getting emotional telling the story. Through it all, through all the questions, through all the uncertainty, we got to a point where with the help of folks at Clarksville, Christians that we didn't even know, medical debt, we ended up having just over $4,000, which we had to be responsible for. We also gave birth to a healthy baby boy, 8 pounds and whatever he was. Yes, that's my wife, human day, all that stuff. But I can remember having those moments where you look at things. You know, as I said a moment ago, when things are good, it's easy to talk about how much you love God. And I know there are other people in this room who have had to go through far worse, who have never, you know, but that's my story. You know, right now that's the closest thing that I can really identify with. But you question it. You wonder, why would God allow us to become present? 6 months in or 8 months in. Why would God do that? And it was the phone call of a sister who has since passed away at Clarksville that kind of set me back in my place. And she called the office one day. And the only way in which Mildred Hunt can do it, she says, Kip, you need to practice what you preach. And it hit me. Hit me right between the eyes. Because I'd stand in the pulpit, I'd talk about faith in God and having faith in God no matter what's happening and on and on and on. But here was my story. And I'm watching all of this, all the pressure, all the stress that comes with everything that we're experiencing here. And here I am worried. Elijah doesn't seem to be worried here, does he? He has an unshakable faith in the Almighty. He has a faith so strong, he's willing to let these guys go on all day long. And at the end of the day, take about 10 minutes to say, sit down and watch this. Again, it's easy when things are going good, when things are smooth, to talk about how much you love God. It's easy to think that when everybody likes us and we have no problem with those around us, that everything's great and hunky-dory. But what do we do? How do we react? How do we respond in those moments where things aren't going so well? We go to passages like James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, where it talks about the benefits and the purposes of trials and problems and such, and how they make us stronger. They give us endurance and all those kinds of things. We need to remember that. You know, those kinds of trials that we encounter are what make us stronger. They make us better for the time that we have ahead. A third thing I want us to note here, as far as the story is concerned, Elijah, as we said a moment ago, he doesn't jump up and down around the altar. He doesn't cut himself. He doesn't, you know, yell and scream and all that kind of stuff. When it came time for him to do his part, he does one very simple thing. He prays. And he prays to God. Now, we look at prayer, if we're probably the average person, as something that is there. It's available. It's something that we do. But are we people of prayer? And by being people of prayer, what I mean is the only time that we pray is it when we sit down to eat in the morning and at lunchtime and at supper time, and then maybe when we go to bed at night or close our eyes? Are those the only times in which we offer a prayer, in which we talk to our God? Because if we do, especially around the dinner table, unless you're my children, we're probably only going to spend about 10 or 12 seconds. Kids, you know, the way they pray, they just go on. We got to the point where we got to tell our children we need a short prayer time when we pray, you know, for our food. Because anything and everything that moves gets mentioned, which is a good thing, but food's getting cold. How much time do we spend in prayer? When something happens, when we have a negative experience, how long does it take for us to begin to talk to God? When we have a moment where maybe something good happens, how long does it take us to offer a prayer of thanksgiving? When we hear of a tragic occurrence, I live in Sellersburg, and you know, if you pay attention to the news, yesterday we had a little bit of an incident there in Sellersburg. A lot of things going on over there, and it's a sad situation on so many different levels. I see on Facebook, you know, people are praying for that, and that's a good thing. How many of us, maybe when we hear of negative occurrences, maybe we talk about the person deserving whatever they get instead of praying for the situation? You see, what we're talking about here is having an attitude of prayer. And it kind of goes back to this whole convenient thing. Making it where, you know, prayer is not just something to be engaged in when we just have a moment. When it's convenient for us, you know, sitting around to eat or going to bed at night or something like that. But to be a people of prayer, to look at prayer as an opportunity to speak openly with the one who does truly care and love us. To have open communication. You ever try to talk to somebody, maybe you try and talk to a boss and maybe the door's always closed? Or maybe you don't really get a chance to talk to them because they don't really want to listen to you, so they kind of just blow you off. But that's not true with the Almighty. We used the illustration earlier of pulling that ticket, you're number one. Imagine that, now serving number one, and everybody who pulls it is number one. God has that ability to do that, to listen, to care about us, to as Paul would say in Philippians, the fourth chapter, verse number six, that he encourages everybody to put upon him the things that are burdensome to us. With all supplication, with thanksgiving, let our request be made known to God. We have a God who cares about us. So why don't we use the one tool that we are guaranteed to gain access to him? I don't know, maybe you're different than the average person. I hope you are. I hope you already have a strong prayer life. But Elijah, he doesn't need to do anything else. He just simply prays. And he does so with confidence. He knows God is listening. God cares about what's happening. He knows that God is going to respond. He knows the power of what he is capable of. And he just asks God to unleash it all. And God does. The
there's a lot to be said about prayer, you know, with this particular example. I have just a few minutes left. I want to look at the last thing here very quickly. This is perhaps the one that affects us the most. There at the very end of our story, in verse number 40, after God sends the fire, it consumes everything that is around the altar and on the altar and all that, he looks at the people and he says, go get them. Go get the prophets of Baal. And they take them down to the brook of Kishon and he slays them there. He kills them. Now we know in the scriptures there are some times where God, according to our human understanding and our human emotions and feelings, and stuff, does some things that we look at as being rather harsh. Can remember where people were given an order to go out and to slay not just the men, but go get the women, go get the children, go get everything that they have, and you kill them all. We look at that and say, man, that's harsh. I suppose in our human minds, that is. It is extremely harsh. This is one of the many ways that God is better than me. Because God has the ability to know the kind of influences that if left unchecked, these people and others would have upon his people. You remember when they went into the land that God had promised to their forefathers so many years before? What were they supposed to do? Just go in and find a piece of land and set up shop and just sit back and relax? No, he says, you go in and you clean the land. You go in and you get rid of everybody that's there. People of Israel did that, didn't they? Almost. They almost did that. And from that point forward, these people became an evil influence, a thorn in their side. So much so that it ultimately caused them to lose their home and to lose their life. We as Christians today need to take the same steps that God encourages people of old to take. And that is to get rid of the evil influences that we have around us. Those things that are troublesome to us, those things that cause us to stumble and to fall, we must be willing, whether it's a job, whether it's friends, whether it's entertainment, whatever it is, if there's something that's keeping you from reaching your potential as a child of God, if there's something that's keeping you from faithful service to Him, you must be willing to excise that stuff out. It goes back to what we talked about in the very, very beginning. Making a decision. You know, there are so many parallels to think about. You look at Lot's wife, you know, leaving the city there, and they said, don't even look back. And they're all running for their lives, and she's the one that turns and looks back, and she's no more. She had a longing to be back there. I don't know if it was leaving her friends, her home, whatever it was that caused her to look back. But the idea I get from Scripture is that there was a longing to be back there. Something still pulling at her. She wasn't quite ready to go, and it cost her life. So as you think about your life tonight, you think about what's going on with you, the influences that you have around you. Are you willing to go to that length? Are you willing to do whatever needs to be done to make sure that there's nothing in this world that will keep you from enjoying heaven someday? One of my favorite passages, and it's kind of an awkward thing, I guess, over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, It's kind of awkward because it's not a very good passage. We talk so much about pearly gates and golden streets. And quite honestly, I don't know if that's what heaven is made of or not. I know there's a lot of descriptive terms used in the Bible, and I just wonder if it's there to kind of give us an understanding that it's better than anything you can ever imagine. But the one thing that has kind of led me to consider it not from the physical, not from what I can visually picture in my mind, it's found there in verse number nine. When the Lord returns, all these things are going to happen. The 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 9. These will pay the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power. Might I suggest to you tonight that that's what it's all about? It's not about pearly gates. It's not about golden streets. It's not about crowns that glisten and glow with jewels and all that kind of thing. Those things are nice. Those are what we strive for in this life. But can you imagine living your life on this planet and doing such a horrible job that you spend eternity outside of the presence of the Almighty? Can you imagine the flip side of that, though? Of being able and willing to do whatever you need to do to make sure there's nothing that keeps that from happening. But to make sure that we are serving God each and every day with the understanding that someday, I get to stand before my Maker. I get to stand before the One who went to the cross and died for me, to look Him in the eye and say thank you. That is what it's all about. I appreciate your attention tonight.